All right, welcome everybody. Tonight is actually our next to last class of the curriculum. This is a second class on the challah crisis, an exploration in daily dilemmas in Jewish business law. So this is called the remaining bookcase. I picked this one because everybody here around the table has, if you're in the city, within the city, you have done one thing. You've definitely moved many times. And there's nothing more annoying than moving. And you realize, how did I acquire so much stuff? How does so much stuff get stuck into my room? So here, pass out some more sheets. Pass them down. Okay. So I'm going to read the case because I'm reading, because I'm trying to record it onto the thing. So here we go. These cases were crafted or found. I found them on the Business Halacha Institute website, which has a repository of a lot of great cases. And you can look it up. It's a great website. And this case called Remaining Bookcase. But let me read it to you. Mr. Green owned a rental apartment. Already, I got Chloe's attention. His current tenant was moving out. A new tenant was slated to move in the following month. Please make sure to remove all your belongings when you leave, Mr. Green instructed his tenant. I'm moving most of the stuff out this week, replied the tenant. However, I have one bookcase of Sfarim that I can't move now, and I will move next week. All right, you see where it's gone. A few weeks passed, and the bookcase and its farm remained in the apartment. The new tenant moved into his belongings in. There's a bookcase sitting in the apartment, he told Mr. Green. I know, Mr. Green apologized. It's from the previous tenant. He was supposed to remove it a few weeks ago. I'd like to set up my own bookcase, said the new tenant. It's in my way. Mr. Green tried contacting the prior tenant, but without success. The new tenant lost patience. If he doesn't come to take his bookcase soon, he said, I'm just going to cart it outside and let him get it from the street, and I'll donate this farm to the yeshiva. I'm not sure you can do that, said Mr. Green. If you leave the bookcase outside, it'll get ruined by the rain and likely taken. What right do you have to give his farm away? Then what do you suggest, asked the tenant. I'll continue to try contacting replied Mr. Green. But if I can't reach him, I'm not sure what to do. Please try, said the tenant. Meanwhile, he called Rabbi Dayan and asked, if Mr. Green doesn't reach the previous tenant, can I leave his bookcase outside? All right, guys. What says you? You moved in, paying the rent, paid your security, schlepping your stuff in, and lo and behold, this big fat bookcase, somebody else, previous tenant, in your living room. Okay, so therefore you're saying what?
I mean, the new tenant has a right to get rid of it any way he wants. Now his belongs. It's now his. It's right. In the place that he's paying.
Oh, so are you saying that the new tenant now has acquired this bookcase?
Yeah.
Okay, so and there you see, you're saying he has, so he can, you're saying he can actually sell it.
Yeah.
So, okay, all right, so that is gone with. You snooze, you lose. Bottom line is, you're given instructions to get the bookcase out. You did not get the bookcase out.
It's not like
I understand that. It now belongs to the new tenant.
I think you know this better, Chloe, but I just remember when I was signing a lease, it basically said, like, everything in the apartment at the time of vacate the apartment, you lose whatever's left there.
Okay. Now, naturally, if there was a contractual agreement, then there would be no question. There wasn't anything. And the guy made a sidebar he said, I'm going to get rid of it in a week. I'll come back and get it. And he didn't follow through. Now, the question, of course, is, does that mean that the first tenant has lost all rights? And actually, Anna goes a step further. Not only has lost all rights, but it comes to possession. First of all, he didn't come. It's not the landlord's.
The landlord is renting out his space. So it's the person who's paying for the space.
The question is, who does this bookcase belong to? The original tenant, the new tenant, the landlord? That is the question. That's why I'm okay. So by the way, I just want to pause right here before we delve into the world of halakha. Is this, let's be honest here. Is this a common phenomenon? Yeah. People always leaving stuff. Okay, throw it out. Now again, if it's in the contract, then it's clear. It becomes, he has agreed to forfeit his ownership. But if that's not the case, what is sort of like halacha is, what's the default understanding, expectation, and right? Okay? So that's what I want to explore. But of course, what we always do is class, I'm going to go around the table and take this. All right, Suzanne, what do you say? What's the deal? Can the guy schlep it out and leave it out on the corner of Broadway and 90th? By the way, you are always so right about that. Who? The landlord. The tenant doesn't know anything about this guy.
Before this guy moves in.
No, the problem is he's already moved in, and this thing is in the freaking living room.
He's got until this day or I am going
if that's it. Well, he probably can't reach him. All right, so you agree with Anna that now the new tenant can sell it? A bookcase could be $500, $600. Sparum could be expensive. Can he make $1,000 selling it? Yes or no? No, but is he, can the new tenant who now has this, the new tenant, in other words, Anna's going aggressive, saying, it's now the new, snooze you lose, now the new tenant, that said the other guy's out of luck, he's selling it, and he's going to make $1,000. You got a problem with that? Okay, so who's the wrong
thing? I don't think he can make monetary benefit of it. I think since it's his apartment, it's his legal space, it's taking up space that he wants to use, and he can get rid of it. But I don't think he can benefit from it monetarily. Especially because it's like...
So what is he supposed to do? So who has to do what?
Actually, responsibility is the landlord.
So the landlord. So what does the landlord got to do? So basically, what the... All right, so basically, right. That seems a reasonable point is that the tenant, number two, the new tenant should say to the landlord, says, Mr. Green. Let's clarify between what is your problem and what is my problem. This bookcase in my living room is your problem. And you and your married man gotta get the touche over my apartment and extract this baby out of my living room, unless you don't want to get paid for the rent. It's up to you.
No,
all right, fine. I'm playing it out. So you say, all right. So you're saying he should. You're saying tenant number two should be aggressive, saying. But he already threatened him. Said, I'm putting it out on the street. Okay. Do you have a complete set? All right, wait. Is this was a complete set? You may right here. Take that. Okay, good. By the way, what's your name?
Jonathan.
Jonathan what? Aharoni. Jonathan Aharoni. Welcome, welcome, welcome. So we're dealing with practical business law. Jonathan, we're a practical business law. And the case was, if you read the case, first case, basically landlord, tenant number one, leaves a bookcase, and he says to the landlord, I'm going to get rid of that bookcase. He goes on him, landlord tries to get him, new guy moves in and says, hey, you got it, there's a huge bookcase with Sfarim in my living room. And there's this nice corner called Broadway and 90th, and that's going to be his new location. I'll donate the Sfarim to MJE, but meanwhile, these bookcases are going to be out of here. I do mix things up. Jamie, what do you say, Jamie?
I think that there's one other part that was like that he mentioned in the story that's very, very important.
Okay.
Make good faith attempts to reach the person who was the original owner.
It seemed like he did.
So now? But I'm saying, like, if he didn't make good faith attempts, okay. I think it would be a very different situation. When he made multiple good faith attempts, tried.
Yes.
And I think he lost. I think the tenant number one lost his rights to said bookshelf because he left it in the apartment. He knew
he was supposed to remove it. He knew his lease ended. He knew he had to remove it. He was contacted multiple times. Apparently didn't respond to any of the attempts. So I think he forfeits his rights of ownership to the bookcase.
Who does it now belong to?
I think it belongs to the landlord, though, because the landlord is the one who ultimately owns the property.
Okay.
And tenant number one is renting from landlord, and number two is renting from landlord. Both of them are renting. Neither of them are truly owning that property. The landlord owns the property. So I think the responsibility that the book helps to the landlord. However, it's also the landlord's responsibility to make sure when he leases an apartment to a new tenant.
Well, he tried. He did his best. I mean, you know, things, right. Stuff happens. Not easy being a landlord.
Right, but I think
that is the truth.
The new tenant has a right to say, hey,
so, but that's not okay. Now, you're never. Can the guy schlep it out and put it outside? Yes or no? Okay. Oh, so you're saying the second they can't touch it. It's in his living room.
No.
Okay. So, Yonatan, what says you, Yonatan? So, now can he sell it?
I don't think.
That's funny. I think the landlord could
when you take ownership of something, you get all rights to that something. You can't say, I own this, except, or you don't truly own it.
You don't own it. He doesn't own it. The guy, he's a rental. He doesn't own anything.
You don't own the thing.
Correct. He has acquired rights of usage for the set time.
Honestly, I wouldn't even make an attempt to sign this person.
If I had guys coming in,
I would have them like an extra $20 to haul it right out.
Okay, come on, welcome in. What's your name? Welcome. You are.
I got all my stuff.
What do you say? Can the guy put it out?
Absolutely, 100%. That day.
That day. Done. Right out. Okay. All right. Scott is, that's it, baby. Scott is Z in it out, baby.
It's already hard enough. I got this giant book.
It's not personal, not very loving.
All right. So we are going to, all right. So I just want to, before we descend into this halachic analysis, which I'm going to take you through it carefully, is that I'm just sharing the purpose of this class and last time class is that in daily life, there's always these misunderstandings, business things that go awry regularly. And we as good Jews have to know what to do. Allegedly, just like we're not going to endeavor not to eat food, which is questionably kosher. We're not going to be involved in financial dealings, which are questionably ethical. You know what I'm saying? I'm just trying to share, just there's a halacha if I put my meat and my dairy and I wash them all together, and that is one challenge, and there's a solution to that. And if I move into an apartment and the schmo before left a bookcase and he was recalled, he's promised to leave it, to remove it, and he did not. So and I'm very angry, but yet I can't just do what I emotionally feel is correct. I need to provide some guidance. So that would be great. I would like to have a little more in my halacha chat. To have more, it's a little bit more weighted on the Shabbat and the Kashrut, which is on board. But I want to have a little more business law because everybody's doing some kind of business. You have employees. You might have a cleaning lady. You might have a babysitter. You might have, we all kind of, you're engaging in contracts all the time. Yes.
All my place in Florida, I got it from, in a short sale. The neighbor moved in with the woman next door. There was stuff left in the attic. So as I called one of these like junk removal companies, he was picking the stuff off the truck and they said, if he picks it off the truck, we're going to charge you anyway. So I basically told him, you can't take your junk that you abandoned when the
home was in Shoreditch. And I felt terrible, but I had already hired this company to remove junk. And he didn't clean it, and I didn't know the stuff was up there.
Okay, we have to, again. That's an equally complex case. We have to do one case at a time. My point being, we're now going to dissect this case. I'm going to read this. What Rabbi Dayan comes up. Here we go. Yeah. Now, possession is 9/10 of the law is an American legal concept.
Right.
There is a corollary to that in halacha, which is that hamotzi mechavero, one who wants to extract money. In other words, you say this guy, hamotzi mechavero, all of the law, you need to provide proof that he owes you money. And if you don't have that proof, all money stays in the current place. In other words, if it's in his pocket, stays in his pocket. Now, if he paid you and he claims he doesn't pay you, well, then you have to bring me a proof that I, in fact, owe you the money back. Okay? So possession, where the money is has great significance. So it's not exactly 9/10. You know, that's a good question. That's a good question. Does that align with the corpus of halacha in regards to property? Here we go. The Gemara in Bava Metzia tells a person who tricked a woman into allowing him to store wine in a property. Nice guy, replied Rabbi Dayan. Because he acted deceitfully, the woman was vindicated, removing the wine at the owner's expense and leaving it outside. Okay, very seems like a perfect corollary. Rambam extends the halacha to one who stored his items in another person's property without permission. However, other Rishonim write that unless the owner acted deceitfully, the item cannot be removed to a place prone to loss. Okay. So there's a debate that basically is that a person like uses your property, stores, sneaks it in, and therefore, you know, do you have the right to put it out in the street because he acted deceitfully? So the Rambam says, if even without permission, so even, the question has to be an act of fraud, or even without permission, therefore they lose their rights, and that's it. All right, that's a debate. We'll get back to that. In our case, even more so, the bookcase was brought in with permission. But the rental lease expired. Moshe Feinstein was asked about a similar case by a Rav who allowed a Esrog seller to store thousands of Esrog boxes in his basement for 2 months. 3 years had passed. Jews, you gotta love them. Gotta love them. 3 years had passed, and the Rav needed to borrow the basement space, but didn't know the Esrog seller's address to contact him. Moshe writes that the Rav is not considered a shomer of aid on the box. He's not a guarder of a lost object, since an owner should have arranged to take them. Now, I'm just going to explain that point. If you find a lost object, a fellow Jew, you become the guardian of that property. Let's say somebody comes over for Friday night and they leave a jacket. You now are responsible for that jacket. You have a lachic duty, and you got to contact that person. You got to get back to them. It's called a lost object, and you are now responsible for that. You have a certain duty of Shmirah, of watching guardianship. He says, this case is not a case of that because they made the deal. He's supposed to get rid of them. Furthermore, although he was a guardian for 2 months, he is no longer so. He previously told the owner to take the boxes. Nevertheless, Ramosha ruled that the Rav is not allowed to actively damage the boxes by putting them outside in a place prone to theft. He suggests that even according to the Rambam, even in the case of deceit and without permission, if the owner is not local to collect his items from the street, they cannot be left there prone to loss without notifying him first of this. Pisri Choshen, there's another later authority, writes similarly that when items were stored with permission and left beyond the time, they cannot be removed to the street. Nevertheless, the Rav allowed the Rav to sell some of the boxes to rent storage space and cover moving costs as the Shulchan Aruch writes. Alternatively, concludes Barai Dayan, you can transfer responsibility of the item to a Beis Din or sell it on behalf of the owner. You can sell it and then hold the money in escrow, as it were. The verdict, a tenant who did not vacate its furniture should be notified to take it out. Otherwise, it should not be disposed of, but be stored at the tenant's expense. Old tenant.
So could you sell parts of the
That's what he said.
Yeah.
So, okay, all right, guys, okay. All right, hold on. Hold on. Okay, hold on. Let's just try to unpack the case carefully. So they're making a very subtle distinction between the cases where the person brought it into the domain without permission or deceitfully. That for sure you can put out. That's it. So the question is, what's the logic of that? Is that because they knew themselves they had basically forfeited that right of being washed because he intentionally did not ask permission? So essentially, he have forfeited the right of the other person taking care of it, because if you want the guy to take care of it, he says, can I put my boxes in your garage? He weaseled in there and snuck it in. Okay? All right. So, but once it's there, now it lapsed. That's the question. Okay, that's our case. Put it in permission, but the time of is lapsed. So what we had by Ramosha was told the guy he could sell some of the property to pay for the space. He cannot put in a place where it's prone to loss. He can't put it in prone to loss. It's not that case. Obviously, the problem was that the question was that the landlord called the person, can't find, the guy is completely ghosted. Calls the number, number's been disconnected. So in a rough patch. So you can, I guess, sell the svarim to pay for space.
That's going to be right.
No, of course that would make it not a halachic question, because the problem is we can't contact the fellow Jew. That's the problem. So correct. So if that, we mentioned that before you came in, which is that if in the contract that the land, that the person said that all property, which I think is typically in a typical apartment lease agreement, any property left in the premises beyond the duration of the thing is defined as ownerless, no longer thing, and is that it can be dealt with the discretion of the landlord. In that case, there's no question, because the person signed a contract which says that they are giving up the right. The premise of the question is that there was much more of a Hamish agreement. Anybody involved in a Hamish agreement? In other words, it's just completely verbal or not that much details written on the sheet of paper among friends. Okay, you have friends. This is very common. You get people. Has anybody helped out a friend and dropped stuff and allowed you your house to be a repository of their stuff? Yes.
With the address
back. Yeah. That was live. We had that. That actually we saw, with Matt and Matt shared that case where the person wanted to leave it over Shabbos, and in fact that the trader bag which had inside the leather coach handbag, her phone and her thing. All right. Okay. So my point is like this. I want to universalize one other point here. Okay. I'll get to James' question next. Very point that in these cases, like all cases of all law, and halacha is no different, and specifically in biz law, where a change of one factor can change the ruling. So the details matter 1,000%, and therefore, when these things happen, you have to share the material fact. Now, if there's a dispute between two parties, as I mentioned, when Matt's case, a dayan is not allowed to rule without hearing both accounts. Okay, so all right, so that's the basic rule. Okay, so just heads up. All right, now we have another case. Jamie, before I go to the next case.
So you did say that you're allowed to sell some of the loans in order to pay for space, et cetera.
Rental, yes.
What happens though, like New York, for example, space is at a premium.
Yes, it is.
Space costs a lot of money, especially storage units. What if selling the IKEA bookcase and whatever is deferring around the bookcase does not adequately cover the cost of the storage?
Right.
Sell all of the items in that case, or is
right? So this seems that they said that's what he said. Transfer the responsibility to the base den, sell it, and then keep that money in an escrow till the guy shows up. Okay, that seems to be. The problem is we don't know where he is. We don't know where the guy is. That's I agree. No, let's step forward. This is the key thing, but let me change the paradigm for a moment. In the perspective of halacha, you put on your halacha glasses and you look at any fellow Jew. What do you see? Maybe. You see, halakhically, you see your brother and your sister. Legally, they're a brother or sister, which means that you cannot just be cavalier with their property. Okay? I understand, though. They're being a yatz. They're yes, 100%. But that's, again, let's make a very simple case. Let's say a person came for Shabbat and left a $200 raincoat in your house, and then they ghosted and they just disappeared. How long do you have to take care of that raincoat? No yelling out. We're using the hand method. Daphne, how long do you have to take care of that? Let's say you really don't know this person. Let's say they got connect you as a place for Shabbos. You are a wonderful Baalat Chesed. You opened your door, Shabbos meal, right? Okay, and they came for a wonderful Shabbos, and it was a beautiful day. It came raining and it was sunny, and they left the jacket, and you never saw a person again, and you cannot track them down. Okay, so the basic law, as I understand it, You have to keep that jacket forever, not Shemitah, forever.
Even though it's a woman's jacket and you can't wear it.
Because you are now, because now you became the shomer of this aveda, this lost object. Or make it, you know what I'm saying? Unless you can contact, then you can make a deal with them. By the way, if you want it, fine, but otherwise.
A rabbi can put together that you can print out if you have a Shabbos meal and like put it on the wall. Anything left here is like.
No, so by the way, hold on, Scott shares with you guys something very important. If you go into a synagogue, into many coat rooms, you will see signs. Just like what you're saying, you are hanging as a any property, which is written by Daphne, any property that's left for 30 days and is not recovered will become hefker, ownerless, and or the property of the synagogue. So that sign is for this problem. Yes. Yes. Now you're going to start noticing it. Believe me. Who raised your hand? Have you heard, seen that sign before?
Look for it now.
Yeah, look for it.
Let's say a tow truck example. Tow truck's a classic example. Any car left over here over
a certain amount of time, that's it. Right. That's the American corollary of that. Okay, correct. All right. Yeah, but correct. Correct. Right. So it's an issue. So all right, I'm not gonna, you know, all right, let's go on to the next case. Next case. All right. All right. I was waiting in a bus stop. Shh, guys, here we go. I was waiting in a bus stop. And someone I know walked up and asked me if I was going to a certain neighborhood. I said I was. And he asked me if I could take a parcel of documents to his brother who was in that neighborhood. I gladly agreed. When I reached my destination, I grabbed all of my packages from the luggage compartment beneath the bus. As it rumbled away, I immediately realized that I had left the parcel of documents on the bus. I called the bus company many times to try to retrieve it, but they claimed that they hadn't found the package, and they say they had no way to help me. When I called the center and informed him of my mistake, he told me that those documents were worth $1,000, which I would now have to pay him. I was shocked. I had no idea the parcel I agreed to take was so valuable. Does the fact that I forgot the parcel make me liable for the value of the documents? I also suspect this person is exaggerating and the documents aren't worth nearly that amount. And I'm required to believe his claim. What do you guys say? Okay, so what's the deal? Now, first of all, you as the person who accepted the thing, what are you? What, you are a showmare? What kind of showmare? Well, here, I'll give you the choices. There's Shomer Chinam, an unpaid watchman. Shomer Sachar, a paid watchman. A Shoel, a borrower. And a renter. Shomer Chinam. You're Shoel Chinam. So a Shoel Chinam is exempt from things except for Shia, negligence. So now we have a case of, what's the fact that he got his stuff from the compartment of the bus and did not take that package of documents, is that a clear case of Shia, which then he's chayev, he's obligated. And if he is obligated, how much has he got to pay? That is the question, okay? Okay, so let's go around the room. So again, go ahead, you start us. Okay. Full $1,000?
I think that he is responsible for the parcel since he was not forgetting. However, $1,000 does sound like a lot to me, and I feel like there needs to be some proof, a way to substantiate
okay.
All
right. Value of the Jamie, you like the way you're thinking? Okay, but Chloe.
He didn't know that the documents were that valuable. Because if had he known, perhaps he wouldn't have taken them.
Ah, good. There was not a disclose. Very important material fact. There was no disclosure of the value. And if he says, here, will you watch my documents valued at $1,000 and bring it to my brother in the next apartment thing? He would have said, no. That's a no for me, dog. Yeah. He said that, then that's it. But he didn't say anything. He just made it very casual. Take the badge up. Sure. All right. What do you guys say? So you say that he's therefore he's exempt. And how much value would you want? Like in the post office, they have a standard value of $5,100, something like that. You know, when you get the basic insurance, there's a basic insurance when you send them thing. They give you
there's insurance. Insurance is you have knowledge of the value of the document. In this case, you didn't have any money. I
see. $100 max. She's going. She's going with $100 max. Okay, Scott.
I'm going like 10%.
$100. Okay, but he has to pay. Yeah. Okay, Anna, what do you say? Let's say the person can prove it's $1,000. All right, so you like Chloe's legal reading of the non-disclosure thing. You don't have time.
It's my own fault. I chose to take your package. You gave me a blank package. Oh, is there anything of value in here? I would probably pay more attention. But it was my choice to not ask anything, blindly accept it. And then I was negligent in leaving it. It's not like someone stole it. It's not like the bus exploded. My own fault. Whatever happened, happened. I'm fully negligent. I think you have to pay.
Oh, so you're the showman. You took responsibility. You stepped up to the plate.
Doesn't change it. I'm still
going to stick. In other words, you stepped up to the plate. You took the package. You could have said no. You could have asked. Okay. All right, Suzanne. Suzanne. There's no rule. We're just, come on, some confidence. No. Okay, let hold on. Suzanne, let me recast the question. What do you think is your best intuition of the locking system? Does this guy have to pay or not pay? Well, because you're a nice person. Halacha is not, hold on. Suzanne, halacha is a floor, not a ceiling. So what do you, give me a number. All right, so you like the disclosure issue. I'm going to go to Nechama, and then Danny gets the last word because she loves the last word. Yeah. I know you're ready, right? Yeah. Nechama, b'vakasha, what do you say? Okay. He should have offered, and he did not. In fact, that you're pinning on the person who sent the package as being a negligence on his part by not disclosing the full value of the package. Okay. Okay, we're going to take a look. All right, Danny, so what says you? Okay, those are all good practical suggestions, but now halacha is it happened. It happened. Now what?
The ruling. I think the fact they're both a little bit guilty.
Okay, so you see there's negligence on both sides, okay? Okay, so what do you say? Based upon the facts. Based upon these facts. It's someone you know. All right, here we go. All right. It sounds like some sort of shara, some sort of midway point between $0 and $1,000. Okay. 500. Okay, fine. All right, here we go. This is what the Dayan says. A shomer, a guardian, is not required to compensate the owner of the object he's guarding for more than the amount he thought the object was worth. Give a high five to Chloe because his liability is limited to the value for which he accepted responsibility. Said Chloe and the Shulchan Aruch. Therefore, if someone gave a shomer, a guardian, a gold coin, but claimed it was silver because he was worried that if he said it was gold, the shomer wouldn't agree to guard it, the shomer liability is limited to the value of the silver coin. I like that. Okay, is that clear to everybody? Okay. The Maharshal writes that this is true only if the owner of the object deceived the shomer. But if the owner did not tell the shomer how much the item was worth, and the shomer accepted the responsibility for it, he's responsible for the full value of the object, regardless of how much he thought it was worth. Just like Yonatan said. He accepted responsibility. There was no words about how much it is. He took the coin. He didn't ask. That's it. You take it, you are responsible. The shach writes, however, this halacha depends on the type of object the owner gave the shomer. Only if that type of object is generally of considerable value, then the shomer expects responsibility for the full value. But if the object is generally of minimal value, then the shomer is not liable for more than that amount. So that goes to the issue about what's the piece of expectation of the package of documents. In your case, since a package of documents could be worth a lot, according to all opinions, you'd be liable for their value. The postman debate, however, whether the forgetting something is considered negligence. The nature of forgetfulness would also make a difference. If a shomer forgot where he put the object he agreed to safeguard, then it's considered serious negligence because he should have created some sort of reminder. If a shomer forgot about an object because he got distracted by any sort of emergency, it would not be considered negligence. In your case, placing the parcel in the luggage compartment is a normal place to guard it when riding on the bus. Leaving something behind in the luggage compartment is quite common. But because it is common, you should have made some sort of mental note to remember to take it. And even if you were negligent, we must consider another aspect of the shaila. The halacha limits liability of a shomer to objects that have inherent monetary value, gufo mamos, things that have intrinsic monetary value. This means that if a document doesn't have an inherent value, but merely enables the holder to obtain money, or a check, for example, or a contract, according to many poskim, a shomer is not liable because he was that even if he was negligent in guarding it. Explain that little point. That's a little bit of a subtle point. The check does not have any value. It is something that demands the person pay. It's an IOU that if it's a check for $100, the person I write, you only send a check for $100, he can demand upon my account $100. But it itself has no value. It is a document that is that ascribes value. It is not its value versus a $100 bill. That's intrinsic value or a piece of silver. Okay. So a shomer who lost such a document could then be entitled to claim Kim Lee. Okay, Kim Lee is another move. Sometimes there is a debate among the halakhic authorities, which you've seen that, about exactly, in this case, we're dealing with negligence, and there's a more stricter position, a more lenient position. Whenever you're trying to get money out of somebody, they can say, Kim Lee, I have the right to describe that I maintain the other position, which happens to exempt me from the thing. He could claim that. Therefore, and absolve him from payment, although he might still be obligated to pay. This is another category, another idea. Latzeis yidei shamayim, to avoid being held in the account. In other words, as we said, there's a basic halacha, which is the floor. What are you, bottom line, have to pay, not have to pay? Then there's sort of this more of a, what would they call the menshi, correct thing to do, is bidei shamayim, that you might be technically not obligated on the technical rule, but it would be a lack on your moral character to say, screw you. The halacha says that there is a category where to fill the higher standard, you should pay even though that you have a halachic justification to weasel out of it. Okay? Now, could he sue you to pay it? No. Because in based in, they can only obligate you to pay, which is, that depends on, you know, what the halachic obligation is. If you, just another caveat. When you go to based in, they give you options. First of all, in order to make things binding in American law, you sign a binding arbitration agreement, saying that you are agreeing that I'm going to act by the decision of this court of law, which is enforceable by American law. Okay, that's how that gives it. Judaism in America, we are a minority. We do not have corporal or capital punishment. We do not have the ability to seize property. Therefore, we evoke that law of an arbitration agreement, and therefore make it collectible as a lien. Collectible in a United States court of law. Okay, then you have the option: are you going to go with din? What is the cold halachic bottom line? Shara, krova the din, compromise, which is basically that is aligned with the din, but not 100%. You know what I'm saying? Where it's not, I say you owe 10,000. I say the other guy said zero. Oh, so we'll split it, $5,000. That's it's not pshar. Pshar called him is going to be like an assessing of what level of responsibilities, negligence, and sort of make some and allow the court to give some sort of best approximation of a compromise thing or pshara altogether. Do that. You make that decision up front. Okay. Now, the guy, if they both pick the din rule, and this was the case, he could at this point he could say Kim Lee, I could ascribe myself to holding the lenient view that I'm not technically liable, okay, whatever. Because this isn't, why? Because these documents are just pieces of paper. These pieces of paper are not worth $1,000. They're worth $1,000 to you because you can collect $1,000 on it, but they are not intrinsically have $1,000 of value. Okay, so these are a little background. Okay, we continue. Now, if the parcel contained cash, which most would consider a goofy moment, the showmer is liable if he was negligent in guarding it. Regarding the question of whether you're obligated to believe, this was, go back to Jamie's point. You're obligated to believe the queen's valuation of the contents of the parcel. The law required the owner to take an oath that the parcel was worth the amount he wants the showman to pay, called the shvua. Okay? Now, since nowadays we do not take oaths because it's using God's name and we try to avoid that, the basin would estimate how much the owner would be willing to forgo to avoid taking the oath. Okay, so they're, you know, so they'll make, or how much would you, so they make some sort of a sort of estimate there. But I want to say, notice that you guys caught all the issues that you brought up were there. The issue of disclosure. And if it's something that, what was the expectation, should there be, you know, gold coin versus silver coin, package of dollars. And then the question is this, how do we evaluate the actual package? Real money or things that would call for money, contracts, checks, et cetera. Next is the question that was also brought up was the issue of, do we trust the person saying it's worth $1,000? Well, then we go, make it the easier case to say, you have to make a shvua that this is worth $1,000 and therefore we'll obligate the guy to pay $1,000 if he's, because they said he's negligent, because basically, if you are storing something in the cavity of a bus, that is the basic thing. You take the stuff out of the compartment with you. That's extreme. That's a complete shia negligence part. So they're basically saying they got to pay the money. They got to work out how much, some sort of, if it was just documents, he has a technicality to get off because say it's not exactly money. He should work out some sort of deal somewhere between zero and $1,000 to compensate the guy for the loss, which he was negligent, even though that he has a loophole way out of it, weasel out of it. Okay, I like this case because it just in a very short case shares the issue of that number one, a showmer, you take responsibility. So if it was, as you mentioned very nicely, let's say they're there, the bus caught on fire. And it burnt up the things. So he's not, that would be a case of onus, and he would be exempt because he's not being paid. Okay. Let me clarify. Even the paid guy is exempt from if it's not his fault, but he would be exempt if it was lost, you know, if it was lost, not his fault, and stolen, not his fault. Okay. Paid, he has to be, he's responsible for that. But now all these gradations of, what is the extent of negligence? What is considered losing it? What is your fault, not your fault? It being stolen, you know, all these things get down to the very granular level of assessment, as you can imagine. All right, I'm running out of time, so I want to get the last case in, then we're going to call it a night. Earning extra. This is also, I love this because it's going to introduce you to a new area. I don't think I've ever discussed this in senior fellowship in the last decade. Here we go. Dr. Bomzer had done some freelance work for one of his clients. He sent him an invoice for $2,000. A month passed with no response. Has anybody here done some work for somebody, sent an invoice, and it was crickets, and you didn't get paid? Has anybody asked? Can you raise your hand if you got the old, I'm sending the invoice and nothing? All right? Dr. Bombs require about payment. I'm sorry, I just can't pay you right now, replied the client. As with Hashem, I'll send a check next week or two. Another 2 months passed. Oh, yeah, these are Jews. Didn't. That should not surprise you. Jews will do this to you. Not even a Shiloh. Another 2 months passed before Dr. Bynum finally received the check with a note. Attached is payment for your service. I added $100 for the delay. Stop right there. What are going to be some of the issues? Interest. Bing, 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 bing. We're going to explore that. All right. Slow down. You're an idiot. Slow down there, Scampi. We're getting there. That was considered, Dr. Bomzer thought to himself. He deposited the check, was considered the additional $100 might have taken the privy to ribbis, as Yonatan pointed out, that he had to return. He didn't ask the client for extra, one person said. He has $100 on his own accord. What's the problem, said Scott Shapiro. Okay, that doesn't make a difference. It's all another, said Yonatan. Another case of ribbis, which is just ribbis. You are not the Torah prohibits charging another Jew interest for a loan. For a loan. Loan. I'm going to get to that. We're going to answer all these questions by 9:15. God will. Okay. All right. That doesn't make a difference. It's another. In all cases, Reuben, he borrowed. If the borrower agrees, the Torah prohibits it. In other words, for example, well, let me clarify. Let's say I tell my friend Chaim, I will lend you $1,000 for 3 months. And after 3 months, you'll give me $1,100 back. But you have to agree to that. If he agrees to that, is that still ribbis? Yeah. Torah violation. Can't do it. Okay, so we're going to get to that. That'll be on point again. It is irrelevant at this point. Claim the third person. You already deposit checks. There's no point returning the money now. Okay. Well, yeah, the money's already in your account. That's why is that? Okay. That is a lame, lazy man answer. Okay. Why not claim to the informant if you hold the money that you shouldn't have taken it? You should return it. Who said there's any problem with ribbis? Said argue fifth person, aka Gaffney. You didn't lend your client anything. He withheld your payment, which was wrong for him in the first place. He owes you some compensation. The late fee. Dr. Brahms considered the very viewpoints. You're all raising valid points, he said. What should I do? Why don't you call Rabbi Dayan and ask him? Dr. Brahms called Rabbi Dayan and asked, am I required to return the $100? Okay, go around the room. All right, Anna, quick. Return, not return. Return. Jonathan, return, not return. Okay, you're going to repeat. Okay, all right, you're going to return. All right, okay, you're going now. That money is snug in the account. Okay, okay, Suzanne, return, not return. No. Gabby, return. Not return. Okay, Nechama. Okay, good. David, Jamie, not return. Chloe, Scott. All right, everybody's got that cash deep into the pocket. Not good. All right, okay. All right, here we go. Let's keep it going over here. All right. The rules of returning ribbis depends on the severity of the ribbis, replied Rabbi Dayan. We're going to find out. We're getting there. The Gemara, okay, hold on. He's giving a little introduction. The Gemara in Bava Metzias 61b teaches that ribbis kitza, standard, stipulated interest for a loan is biblical, which is biblically prohibited, must be returned and borrowed, can demand and based it. Okay. So when I gave you the case of the 3 months and I give you $1,000, you give me $1,100 back. Standard ribbis kitzutza, which means it's a very defined amount. I give you $1,000, you give me I give $1,100 back, 3 month time, biblically, and I can then say, hey, I can take it to based it and I can get the $100 back. And he must return it in advance. Now, returning avak ribbis is something that is not quite ribbis, but it has, avak means the dust of ribbis. It's ribbis-ish, okay? Well, okay, which means most forms of rabbinically prohibited ribbis is not enforceable. Nonetheless, many Rishonim write that the lender has a moral responsibility to return even avak ribbis. You're not chayav to do it, but it would be the right thing to do, going back to that other category. However, the Rama, which represents the Ashkenaz position in the Shulchan Aruch, based on the response of the Rashba, Shalom ben Aderet, rules that there is not even a moral obligation to return ribbis me'ucheres. Okay, let me explain that. Which is borrowed gives on his own initiation after paying the loan. Here's a case. This is a good case. You ask your friend for $1,000. He gives you $1,000. You pay it back, and then you hand him $100. No word said. What? You just hand him $100. That's ribbis mucheres after the loan has been repaid. Sort of like a. Okay, so we're gonna get to that. So and there's Ribis Mukdemes, where you basically take them out to Wall Street Grill. And then you ask them for a $10,000 loan.
No, either one.
The pre and the post.
You're setting the stage.
You're warming them up. Or you're thanking them. You know, if you didn't say the word, you didn't say interest. You greased the palm a little. Pre or post. So that's rabbinically forbidden, and that's. Okay. Yes. Okay. Now, yes. It's forbidden. Now, this is rabbinically prohibited because the rabbis want to basically. Now, let me just back up one thing. We mentioned a couple classes ago that the loan in Judaism is the highest form of tzedakah. It's to help somebody else before they become poor. And the word ribis is where it's kind of where they have the word neshach. Neshach means to bite. You're basically, well, we actually use the word price gouging. You know, you're taking advantage of the person who's vulnerable and needs the money and will agree to this pay loan, terrible, has no choice but to take the bad terms because they're in bad case. So we have to treat our brothers and sisters, our fellow Jews, in a way where we do that. Now, there's between that a loan who's in a bad shape versus a, you know, helping out a business in more of a business loan investment thing, capital, where they have a thing called a heterisca, where the loan gets transferred to a basin and therefore would allow interest to be charged. Okay, that's it's a workaround. But for a person, it shouldn't really be done. I'm just giving you some awareness of different things. Let's finish it off because we're getting late over here. Okay. Seemingly, the rationale is that since the borrower gives the additional amount on his own initiative as a gift, there is sincere mechila. We're not for the prohibition of ribis. In other words, he's giving it in a full hearted way. It's unrelated to the loan. Thus, while the lender is not allowed to accept ribis milcheres, in other words, he should have said no to the gift, the $100, or said no to the dinner at the Wall Street Grill. He should have said no. Once it's given, post-fed is not even a more obligation return. Again, because it's a rabbinic thing. Because if it was fully, or it comes very, if that gift has become unrelated, truly a gift, unrelated to the fact that you just had a loan transaction, then that's considered not a problem. Post-facto. Now, when the borrower adds additional on his own accord when returning the loan, not afterwards, regarding certain halachas, there's more severe than ribis milcheres. Regarding this halacha, there's a dispute whether there's a moral responsibility to return the extra. Many achrim rule that is like ribis milcheres, and when it does not have even a moral responsibility to return it, the aforementioned rationale applies here as well. In addition, some authorities rule that the debt emanating from work is different from a loan, said Daphne. The employer who withheld wages is permitted to compensate the employee for the delay. Although others do not differentiate, it is not clear this prohibited ribis. That was Daphne's point. Thus concludes Rabbi Dayan. While it is questionable whether you were allowed to deposit a large check post facto, you do not even have a moral obligation to return the extra $100. Verdict. Although there's a moral responsibility to return avak ribis, this is the rabbinic forms of ribis, the lender does not have to return ribis milcheres, which the borrower gave on his own initiative, especially for withheld work earnings. Okay? So a couple of takeaways that I want you to be aware of is that just, you know, loans, see that the rabbis wanted to make loans really clean. You give the loan, and even saying thank you, by the way, is a lot of questions. Even saying thank you, because that might be, that's an example of vaka ribbis. I borrow $1,000, and you think you shouldn't say that. Because that giving of that additional social thing, it's a whole debate whether or not it's like a convention, but if it's being that you're gaining that social hierarchy, edge, he owes you. That also has an avak ribis. It's not technically money, but it is a benefit. A pure loan to a fellow Jew who's in trouble should be, don't worry about it. Here's the money. Work out terms. Should be signed contract. Should be written out. Send an email. You want to have documentation. Don't want to have a fight about it. You don't want to end up as being next week class. Okay. I don't know the money. Okay. All right, that's it. So that's the basic deal. Then we have issues about the pre and post giving money. In other words, the either sweetening the deal, which is a kind of giving an additional benefit for the loan, either pre or post. And then, and the question, if he does it before, since the question, it might be a true mechila, in other words, he gave it with a full heart, unrelated to the loan event or not, post facto, there's a debate about that. So once he put the money in his account, he doesn't have to give him extra $100 back. And another question, which was the argument that the legal reasoning that Daphne pointed out, is that withhold wages is not really enough, it's outside the realm of loans altogether, and may not be subject to the issue of ribbons altogether. And you give him $1,000 extra as a compensation. What we didn't discuss, which is the other thing, is like late fees. You get a company, like you get 30 days, you get 60 days to pay your bill. You don't automatically slapped on is 2%, 5% of the thing. That itself is how is it structured? It gets very subtle. Right? I'm not really prepared to give an answer. I'm just giving a very simple one question. These happens all the time. Has to be done with a wisdom. I recommend if you want to expand your knowledge, go onto the website Halacha Business Halacha Institute. .org or com, I don't know what it is. They have all these kind of interesting cases. You can actually email them questions. They have operators standing by 24/6. Okay, 24/6. They're looking to help you out. And that's it. All right, guys. All right, Yeshua Koach, we did a lot of good stuff. And next week we got Adina. Then we're going to have a little party. That'll be our last class of July the 6th. We'll do a little review of our last bunch of classes. And then we'll call off for summer. Yeah, and then we're
thank you, there. Rabbi.
All right, Evan, thank you so much for coming. See ya. Yeah, July 6th, our last class, everybody. And then if someone's going to Israel, that'll be Jamie. All right.
I'm coming, Benny.
Evan's coming as well. Beautiful. All right, bye.